Hey, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I know at some point I'm going to stumble over the name. And when I do, I got no one to blame but me. This was my idea, my title for the podcast. I wanted to at least make it seem different. And there's been a lot of people out there with suggestions for what they think the podcast should be called. And let me say this off the top. There's a lot of good choices. A lot of good names out there. Maybe some, maybe that are better than mine. You know, I had one relative who say I should have called the podcast Cause I Love Wine. This is my last name, C-A-U-Z. And I'm like, yep, that's a great name. Again, the problem, not wordy enough. Too compact, too tight, too, you know, rolls off the tongue. Who needs that? So I want to say thank you first off to everyone who listened to the first episode, and a lot of really nice things were said on Twitter, social media, and whatnot, and I really appreciate it. I just want to grow this podcast, get more and more interesting guests in the near future. In fact, we got a great guest on this one, the first guest, and we talk about how it's going to be interesting people. Well, the guy that you'll hear this interview in about 20, 25 minutes with is certainly that. His name is Duque Corsini. And yeah, everyone knows me. I mispronounce names. Duque Corsini. I might even mispronounce it there. Here's what you need to know about him. His family, their wine cellars was constructed in 1600, three underground levels. It's gorgeous. But he is actually a prince. He's a legitimate prince in Tuscany. His family has got royalty. Way back when, like in the 1700s, one of the members of his family, who was 78 years old, was elected pope. 78? And elected or voted, I'm not sure. But 78 years old, and actually stayed as pope for 10 years. I bet there's got a lot of people that were gambling that didn't give that Corsini 10 years. Like, if I don't know what the over-under was, but in the 1700s, the average life expectancy was not exactly 78 years old. Anyway, what you need to know, killer Chiantis, Chianti Classicos, just an incredible expression of what Tuscany is supposed to be about. I'll give you more bio on him near the end of this intro and just give you a little more details about him before you listen to that interview. But what I want to do in every podcast is I want to give you at least one wine tip, and by that, a tip on how to be a wine expert / snob, maybe a douchebag, without having to work, without having to study, train, or anything at all. So I'm going to give you one tip on how you can impress at your parties where you will seem like the biggest wine expert, even though you're totally BSing it. Also, I want to give just a thought or two about always something in the world of wine, and I want to give a wine recommendation. And today's, which I'll talk about 5-10 minutes, it's a California Chardonnay for under $20, just barely under $20. I'm talking about like when you would order a pizza years ago, and it was 30 minutes or free, and the pizza delivery person would show up 29 minutes and 30 seconds in. That's it. But it's still under $20, and it's damn tasty. But what I first want to talk about is wine etiquette at wine tastings. And over the last couple days, I've gone to two pretty large wine industry events. And basically, these are usually divided into the trade portion for people in the business and then public. And I get to go to the trade portion side, which is great because it's a little less crowded. And that's it. Also, I always know people there. My girlfriend always, you know, she feels bad because I go to these events on my own. I tell her I would way prefer to go to them on my own, and I'll discuss why in a second. But I've got one major piece of advice for anyone out there. If you are going to go to one of these events, again, if you're going to go to a trade one, maybe you're new in the wine business, or if you're just someone who loves wine, and you probably do love wine if you're listening to this right now, and you're going with for the public aspect of the night, I cannot stress this enough, and it's a little expression I call pour and slide. What I mean by this is the moment, wherever you are, the moment your glass has been filled with usually free wine, please move to the side. Now, if there is no one standing behind you, if you get lucky enough where there's a lull in the crowd, just there's no one around, spend as much time as you want. Talk, yammer, you know, ask about the story of the wine, ask about the grapes, the oak program, I don't care. But there's nothing worse than when you go to one of these events and there's a massive lineup And usually it's going to be around the French wine or the Italian wine, you know, especially if there's a star wine there, especially on the trade side, but not in the trade side. Everyone knows, even on just, you know, the ones that are open to the public, y'all know. We always know who the big star is. You know, it's like if you go to Q&A for a movie, you're not going to stand in line to talk to, you know, one of the people in the background. You're going to talk to George Clooney. Same thing here. Especially like, say, Burgundy. If it's Premier Cru or above, there's going to be a lineup. And there's nothing more infuriating than people talking and yammering and talking with their friends about the wine and about their day, or, you know, they're talking to whoever poured the wine and asking 100 questions. That's what Google is for. I could never do that. I hate the idea of making people wait in line. And I'll be standing there quietly. They know I'm standing there, but they're still talking. And they don't just do this to me. They do this to everyone. The level of self-entitlement for this is shocking. And I see this at all the different levels, like people like restaurant owners and, you know, SOMs and everyone in the business. They do it. I mean, they know better. And I mean, again, Google it. You can find all the information. And I get it, especially when the winemaker is there. You know, you want to talk to them. I do as well, sometimes just to go, hey, fantastic work. I've been drinking your wine for X amount of years, you know, and like you want to be like a giddy fanboy about wine. But there's still a time and a place for it. You know, you can keep an eye to see when the crowd's less. And then, you know, and it's okay, by the way, 15 seconds. Go, hey, love this wine, blah, blah, blah. What you're doing, the Syrah is crazy. But then try to be considerate because there's a lot of people behind you. So that is my main tip at these events. Please do it for the people behind you. So a couple other thoughts. One, especially if you are just a wine enthusiast and you're going to like a trade event and you want to feel like you want to fit in, you got to spit a lot because, you know, they can sense who the amateurs are. They're the ones that are sitting there just getting drunk. And I get it. It can be tempting. You're getting poured all this wine, you know, from all over the world at different price points, white, rosé, red, start with the sparkling. It's easy to get drunk. Heck, at one of the two events I was at, I was getting a little bit tipsy by the end because there wasn't a lot of spit buckets. It was really crowded, and I didn't want to be that person that was barging, ramming my head through a couple sets of shoulders as I was, you know, trying to spit. So by the end of the event, now, thankfully, there was a bunch of wines I wanted to try because I was going to purchase some wine. I tried everything I wanted to try. I made all the notes I wanted to make. And then, you know, you're just talking to some people. And by the end of it, it becomes a bit more of a social function. And there's a couple really tasty BC producers that make some great Chardonnay. They had heavy pours. There was not a spit bucket around. I was not working the next day, and I did not drive. So I left a little bit tipsy. But for the first, you know, 80%, a lot of spitting, so can't recommend that enough. And yes, also, do never drive to a wine event. You know, especially if you live in a big city. There's subway, there's you know, TTC buses, Uber cabs. Do not be that person. Just ridiculously stupid. And final little tip, do not wear cologne, perfume, or aftershave. And you might not know this. At one point, I didn't know this. I had no idea, but it's really simple. Cologne, aftershave, perfume, whatever it is, it will inhibit your ability to smell the wine. And wine tasting, I know the word tasting is the second word. That's because they're not going to call it wine smelling or wine nosing, because wine smelling would seem creepy and wine nosing would sound pretentious. But smelling the wine is so important. I'm not, you know, I hate to go Captain Obvious, but you are going to assess so much about the quality, the character, the depth, the complexity of the wine by how it smells. It's one of the true joys of being in the biz is being able just to smell crazy, interesting, funky, lovely, fruity, whatever stuff. And you put on the perfume and it masks it and all you smell is Chanel or Axe body spray. And I'm going to tell you right now, no wine should ever smell like Axe body spray. In fact, if a wine does smell like Axe body spray, it is faulted. It's probably poison and it'll give you a big case of the douchiness. Excuse me now about being douchey. I'm going to take a sip. Now, how did I learn about not wearing perfume or cologne? I learned the hard way. I got shamed, rightfully shamed about it. I was working for a consignment company, a wine consignment company called Barrel Select. By the way, the one of the owners of Barrel Select, Dawn Bailey, she'll be on this podcast sometime in the late fall. And I worked there briefly, and they flew me out to Sonoma to try a bunch of the different wines from a lot of the winemakers that they're involved with. And then we went to dinner the first night, showered, put on the aftershave. At some point between the drive when we get to dinner, they look at me and like, why? They're like, what's that smell? I'm like, huh? Like, are you wearing aftershave? And I was like, yeah. I was shocked. No one's ever asked me that question before. And then they calmly explain what I just explained to you, that how could I be expected to assess any of the wines? Or some of the wines we're having for dinner or some of the wines we sell. How can you possibly be expected to talk about this wine or assess this wine when your nostrils are filled with aftershave? I didn't fight. I didn't have any pushback. I was just like, oh, bleep, you're right. You are 100% right. And that was about 9 years ago, and I have not worn any sort of cologne, aftershave, or perfume for that matter since. So those are some of my thoughts about etiquette and things to do and not to do at wine tastings. And you'll be amazed how many people have perfume or cologne on. From big wine events like the California Wine Show at the Royal York Hotel in Toronto to like smaller ones, like the wines of Portugal. And there, I saw these two women and they were dolled up like getting ready to go for a nice dinner. And they also had perfume. You could smell it a mile away. They're the only ones with perfume. And I remember thinking, like, this is the wines of Portugal. I mean, this is a little bit more under the radar event. You know, you're not going to get the same, and though you should, because, I mean, a whole day of drinking Tawny and Ruby and, you know, vintage ports and some great sherries and on and on and on. I said sherry. Sorry, that's Spain. My bad there. And just, you know, some really cool Portuguese wines from grapes. So, you know, Torriga Nacional, obviously, but a lot of other grapes I can't pronounce because a lot of it is stuff that is just, you only find it in the soils, in the Douro and stuff. And I can't pronounce it. Just a lot of the varietals in Portugal are tricky. But even there, I smelled perfume. Like, what are you doing? Like, this is kind of more of a hipster event. Speaking of hipster. That gets into my next point. Every podcast, as I said at the top, I want to try to give you one tip about how to be a wine expert without knowing anything about wine. And for this one, it is go full hipster. Here's what I mean. You need to pick a region of the world, a wine region, an incredibly famous wine region in the world, and you need to declare how much you hate it or you're tired of it. Then you need to pick an area that no one drinks wine from, even if it's an area that makes wine and, you know, probably it makes some really damn good wine, but, you know, rarely does it ever hit Canadian soil or American or wherever you're listening to this. And you have to say how much you love that wine. So I'll give you an example. This is one of my favorites, is you start off by declaring that you are so done with Bordeaux. Then on the backside, again, you talk about, I'm just tired of Bordeaux. All I've been drinking lately has been Bulgarian Cabernet or Cab Sauv from Bulgaria. Bam. If you do that, that immediately creates the impression of your knowledge and your intelligence and your wine experience. Because first off, who is ever tired of Bordeaux? I mean, I get sometimes you take a break from it, but when you say you hate it or you're done with it, that's absolute BS. But it creates this image of you that's, you know, been traveling throughout the Medoc and Pomerol and Saint-Emilion and that you've got your hands in the soil and you've been drinking all the growths from first down to fifth, a bunch of super seconds. You've been drinking some cool garage wine from Saint-Emilion and you've been, you know, your hands dirty with the clay and Pomerol. You know, get out of here. Get out of here. So, and then also, how many people listening has ever tried Cabernet Sauvignon from Bulgaria? I mean, they make it, and I'm sure there's lots of good examples of it. I've read about it. I've never tried any really good Bulgarian Cabernet Sauvignon, but the great thing is probably everyone at the party or the restaurant, wherever you are, they haven't either. They're not going to question you on it. They're not going to suddenly go, okay, hot shot, pop quiz, tell me the acidity and taste profile of this Bulgarian cab. So everyone will be so impressed. Now, you know, you'll come off somewhere between hipster and douchebag, but again, it does create the impression you know what you're talking about. So my job is done. Now you know a little bit another way to seem like a wine expert without having to do all the silly things like, you know, studying. Time for the wine. And this is definitely not a hipster wine. This is the Wente Morning Fog Chardonnay. It retails in Ontario for $19.95. This wine is from an area called the Livermore Valley, which is a wine region east of San Francisco. And because it's in a valley in the high hills, that helps to protect where the grapes are growing from the cooler influences from the Pacific. So it still is fairly warm. Now, they still get enough of a breeze where it's not super hot, so you don't get like big, flabby, you know, Chardonnay grapes. This wine, I'm going to go to the website, says it's fermented 50% in neutral American oak barrels, 50% in stainless steel tanks. You can definitely taste the oak. And as I listen to the game, the Toronto Maple Leafs have just scored on the Dallas Stars, and I get an idea what time this is recorded. 1-0. Ooh, looks like Mitch Marner. Anyway, sorry, back to the pod. This wine, you can definitely taste the oak. I'm not saying it's overly oaked. It's not, but it is not subtle. It's integrated, and even there's a little extra oak there. There's a little bit more of that vanilla on both the nose and definitely on the palate and a big mouthfeel. And I am a fan of oaked American Chardonnay. I'm not a fan of when it's overly oaked, over the top, and it's basically stinging you, and it feels, you know, you're getting slivers on your tongue. I don't like that. But I'm unapologetic, you know. There are people out there that are going to talk about how Chardonnay, you know, must have only a hint at most, and they'll wax poetic about Chablis. And you know what? They should wax poetic about Chablis. Chablis is awesome. You know, that stainless steel stuff or just very lightly oaked Chardonnay that you get, you know, in so many parts of Burgundy are fantastic. I love them. I, you know, drink them every day. But I do love my oaked California Chard. I'm not even going to say it's a guilty pleasure because to say that would be an insult. So you're going to get a lot of tropical fruit. The juice... In the remember the fruit can Dole fruit cans of pineapple. Think of a little bit of that with a little bit of mango and a little bit of banana, and that's a lot of what you're getting here. It's not overwhelming. I'm making it seem like it's this big sugary juice drink. It's not. Like there's good acidity here. This is a well-made wine from a company in Wente. I mean, they know what they're doing. They've been making Chardonnay for so long. This is a really good company, and it's not overly expensive. And part of it is it's because it's in Livermore Valley, which is, you know, real estate there. I haven't checked it, but it's going to be cheaper than so many parts of Napa or, you know, Sonoma, Russian River Valley, things like that. And again, that's one of the reasons why wine costs what it does. It's not just about magical winemakers or the terroir. It's literally, part of it is, how expensive is the land? If you buy a property in Champagne, much more expensive than Livermore Valley. So highly recommend this. Again, $19.95, a damn tasty Chardonnay. It's not going to blow you away with depths and complexity. There's enough there. This is just enjoyable. It's just an enjoyable, fun expression of what I want from my California Chardonnay. You know, it's not like the high-end David Ramey stuff, one of my favorite California producers of Chardonnay, but damn tasty and one that I drank a lot of. All right, moving on to the interview. I've talked too much. Duccio Corsini. He is a counselor for the Chianti Classico Consortium. He talks about that in the podcast. He's been making wine for, you know, basically like the last 40 years. And the interesting thing is he graduated with a degree in modern history at Milan. And then he went from eventually taking over his family's wine business. And the wine business that he took over, it wasn't like some high-end source for Chianti. The opposite. It was bulk wine, selling a lot of its grapes. You know, wine wasn't seen as, let's do a brilliant expression of the terroir of Tuscany. It was more just a way to make money. He takes over and transforms it. And I interviewed him about a month and a half ago for a wine event at the National Club in Toronto, and we tried a whole series of his Chiantis, Chianti Classicos, you know, just 100% Sangiovese's or some, Merlot blend and others, his Vinsanto, really good. And this interview for just, you know, is definitely a little bit more hardcore wine talk. But for people that are just getting into wine, I think you'll find him interesting. Really smart man, really nice guy. His English is very good. His English is definitely a lot better than my Italian, but I think the interview comes out pretty good, pretty clear, and just a really great guy. And I really appreciated that he took time out of his day because he was traveling across Toronto, going to events and then doing the dinner at the National Club. He took about half an hour of his time to interview with me. So I am going to end the podcast here. Coming up next will be the interview, and then we'll wrap it up there. But I want to thank everyone again. You can listen to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. It is on Apple iTunes. It is on Audio Boom. We're going to get it on Stitcher soon. So if you like it, please tell your friends. We want to try to grow. Eventually, there'll be listener questions. I want to grow this community out there because in the end, this is just about trying to entertain and a little bit teaching and just imparting the fact that wine is fun and it's a great thing to learn about and it's a great little thing to add to your life. So anyway, enjoy the interview. Time now for Corsini. And I'm here with Duce Corsini, one of the most famous producers of Chianti, of Sangiovese in all of Italy. Duce, thank you so much for taking time to be part of this podcast.
It's nice to be here. It's an honor to be considered one of the best producers of Chianti Classico in the Chianti region.
Well, I mean, the thing with your products is you've hit that almost cult-like status. Now, not cult-like status of prices, like what you see at Screaming Eagle and Napa, but, you know, your reputation obviously precedes you. We're here at the National Club. As we record this, it's the morning. We're doing a tasting of a lot of your wines. I want to talk to you about the wines, how you make them, your decisions for more Merlot and with some of them, none with the Zach. But before anything else, I'd love to hear a little bit about your family and how your family is connect. For people who don't know, how the Corsini family is connected with the Pope.
So the Corsini family history is a long history, and it starts in the 12th century. There were very simple people that ran from the village of Poggibonsi and came to Florence and start what Florence is famous for, trading, and then after trading, banking, so trading money. And with the success of Florence and these families, the huge and immense development of Renaissance. I mean, Renaissance is Florentine, basically. So, and the family is one of those that still today exist. I am the last one of a long bloodline that contributed to make Florence and Europe and the world famous for the Renaissance, mm-hmm. not only in art and architecture, but also in the end in wine production and many other things.
And how does the Pope get involved with all of this?
The Pope comes in in 1730. You know, he was elected Pope. His name was Lorenzo Corsini, and he was elected Pope at the age of 78. Probably the Roman families thought that it was time. They needed more time to have the right pope among
right.
themselves, and they
78. That's pretty old to be elected as the pope.
They probably wanted him to last a couple of months, just the time to make a final decision on them. And he overlived their ideas for 10 years, being a very very important pope in the terms of architecture, of finance, and of organization of the state of the church. I mean, it's not for example, the Trevi Fountain that is it's worldwide famous monument.
Yeah,
it's not just a fountain. It's the end of the pipeline that brought water to the city.
Want to talk about? Well, I mean, there's a ton, but I'm always curious to ask this question: was there a bottle? Was there a moment? Was there anything specific, that epiphany moment when you started to fall in love with wine? Now, obviously, this is a little bit different with you because it goes in the family tradition, as you've mentioned, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But was there a moment when you realized, this is what I want to get into?
Not exactly. I was asked by my father in 1992 if I wanted to look after this property, Villa Le Corti, that was bought in 1363. So, but there was no tradition in the sense we think today in making wine. There's a long tradition in owning land and managing properties, mm-hmm. and make it work well. but not exactly in the terms of making wine in our days. So right. I thought I took the challenge.
And also, if I can interrupt, I believe you graduated with a degree in modern history in Milan.
Yeah, exactly.
So you went from modern history in Milan to taking over this property, La Côte, which is in the northern part of the Chianti Classico region. So you went from modern history to starting to spearhead what's now a very famous line of Chianti. How did you make that jump?
Well, I said yes to my father, first of all.
Yeah.
I thought it was a fantastic property, only 18 kilometers south of Florence, and it could have been a perfect real estate project.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, the real estate projects in Italy needs time, and in that time, I had to manage the estate. And there was olive trees and vineyards that made Chianti Classico. And I started managing and understanding, and I fell in love with Sangiovese and the style of the wine.
Yeah.
And what the potential, the emotional potential that Sangiovese has at the same level, or sometimes can be more than Nebbiolo and Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no bottle that helped me into this, but just watching nature evolve and develop.
So the interesting thing about this is, I think most people assume, because it's in Europe, that the winemaking's been going on for hundreds of years. But for you, you stepped into it, and it wasn't just about wine. It was about real estate and olive oil. So I'm curious, how different was the wine being made then versus the stuff we're going to drink tonight at the National Club?
I would say that in short, Le Courtier, when I came in, it was in the Middle Ages of wine, while the whole of Tuscany was already bumping through the Renaissance of Italian wines that started again in Tuscany. It was 92, and the success of the great Super Tuscans happened in the mid-80s. So between 85 and 90.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there looking at my real estate project and in theory and practically managing fantastic Sangiovese grapes. So when I understood that, it was, the passion came and gripped me. So there's nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
You cannot avoid that. And so I said, this is amazing. We can do this. We can do better. So from a traditionally managed estate that made wine, most of it to be sold in bulk.
Okay.
In 25, now 26 years, I can say we are happy to be recognized among at least the 5 best producers of Chianti Classico.
That's an incredible story. It's
funny. Takes time.
What's that? It
takes time.
Of course. But that's a remarkable transformation to go from bulk wine producer to a much more, artisanal and small, smaller amount of wine. And you say made it better. What were some of the biggest improvements that you implemented?
Well, first thing is farming.
Mm-hmm.
So farming to make excellent wines is different from just farming to make grapes that will make average wine.
Right.
This needed attention, understanding, and understanding of the terroir and the climate, the land, and overall accepting the tradition of the people that worked there. Today, I consider terroir just a part of the identity of a wine. The main part of the identity of wine is us, me.
Mm-hmm.
Me, my taste, my way of managing the property, and all the team that follows me in this. So there is more than just land, river stone, climate, mildness related to the influence of the seaside or things like that. It's a genius loci, I would call it today.
Talk, you're showing me a map, and obviously it's a podcast, people can't see it, but I was wondering if you could explain to people just a little bit about where your land is located and the soil. I know that the vineyards are more in the more northern part of the Chianti Classico region.
So if we look at from the moon, Chianti Classico is in Italy,
mm-hmm.
in the central part, in Tuscany. and stands between Florence and Siena. It's not a big terroir, it's not a big territory. And within this territory, there are 7, 8 villages. To be exact, there are 9 villages. And we are in the northeast part of this territory, that is the village of San Casciano in Val di Pesa. And it's the nearest to Florence. One of the characteristics of this area in terms of terroir is that our land is made mostly of river stone. That is quite unique for the whole of Chianti Classico. There are sediments, fluvial sediments, like if it was grave. Another characteristic is as we have nothing between us and the seaside on the west, that when there is a quite strong influence of the climate from the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
That, in terms of practical terms, means that we peak earlier than other parts of Chianti. We are like 1 week, 10 days before time, normal time of the central and south part of Chianti Classico.
How does that impact the wine?
Oh, the wine, the land impacts the wine because we never produce, our natural production is elegance, minerality, perfumes, strong, you know, and not full body.
Yeah.
So our wines in San Casciano will be mainly medium body, elegant, mineral, like French say, digest wines, mm-hmm. easy to drink. And this is now, finally, it's a positive characteristic, no? The fact that the wines are easy to drink. We make them to drink them anyway.
Yeah. You talked about a couple minutes ago about farming, and I was looking at old interviews by you, and you talked about how, as farmers, you're fundamental for the survival of the planet. I'm curious, and this goes off wine a little bit, but what are your thoughts about climate change? It's funny because you people always weigh in on it on both sides, which seems a little odd, and we see that, you know, people are picking grapes sooner because things are hotter, and you can now make more wines in Germany or southern England because everything seems to be a little bit warmer.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, as someone who views so much of your job is as a farmer, what are your thoughts just on climate?
Climate change is something that is part of our, you know, of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The climate has changed many times and has been very violent in some periods of the history of Earth. I can sense the change from 92 until today.
Oh, yeah?
A little bit, yes. Mm-hmm. Our wines have more sugar. Mm-hmm. Our vines have more sugar. We tend to pick earlier because of that, to reduce the quantity of sugar in the wine. Especially in the last 10 years, we want we don't want full body, so at least Le Corti, we don't want full body.
Yeah.
We want more elegance and easy to drink rather than big, powerful, chewy wines. But it is a question of taste, personal taste. In order to do that, I experienced a week ahead during harvest. We've also experienced drought, lack of water, natural rain, lack of natural rain, or tropical season like this winter. I mean, and spring, it has been raining for a couple of months, almost every day. At a certain time, like if we were in St. Lucia or wherever in the Caribbean Sea,
mm-hmm.
every day at a certain time it rains.
Yeah.
This is, what do I think of that? I can think many things, but I know that it's very difficult for me, to change. We contribute to the health of the planet as farmers, organic farmers, because our production helps to make, you know, nice air, clean mm-hmm. water. Our production. There might be some industrial farming that is not quite in the same pattern, but the plants still give more than what they take. And as long as we act and behave as the plants do, so we try to take less than what we give.
Yeah,
this is going to be a future.
Yeah. So for the wines themselves, some of the quotes I was looking up, I'd love for you to talk about just the role of Merlot. You've mentioned that Sangiovese sometimes has rough edges to it, and Merlot can help smooth them out. For people that, you know, some people listening to this are hardcore wine people. They know all of it. And other people, they're just interested in learning about wine. It's part of what this podcast is about, just teaching people about wine, having fun with it. And just what does Merlot mean for you guys? Obviously not the Zach, but from some of your other line of red wines, what does Merlot do? And one more thing. I'm sorry, now I'm just yammering. But I know that used to be just about 5%, 10% Merlot. Now there can be up to 20% in the blend.
So this has a bit to do with Chianti Classico wine. Chianti Classico wine is a blend wine. Historically, it has been like that. There was white grapes in the blend up to the mid-90s. Then the white grapes were taken out. Now there is a blend of only red grapes. The majority, the lord of the Chianti Classico is, of course, Sangiovese. But there is a freedom for producers to be, what I said, genius loci, to influence their style and to influence their terroir. By doing what? Adding to Sangiovese also specific varietals, depending on what they do and how they do it and what is their taste. There are traditional red grapes such as Canaiolo and Colorino and Malvasia Nera, or modern or reintroduced grapes such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. It's, we all say, very international varietals, but all varietals come from Asia, and they were brought to Italy by the Greeks and Romans, and then the Romans brought them all the way to England. So,
yeah, it's
what
funny.
Is...
I noticed that. Yeah, Sangiovese is Italian, but Cabernet is international.
Yeah, I mean Veneto, on the northeast of Italy, is all about Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot and Cabernet, they call it. I think that our wines, we make all the three Chianti Classico categories. So the regular category, Le Corti, that is 95% Sangiovese and 5% Canaiolo. So I would say it's almost all Sangiovese. The same we do with the Riserva, ours is called Cortevecchia. Mm-hmm. With the Gran Selezione, Don Tommaso, I use Merlot. Merlot was used in the beginning as a sparing partner, you know, like a golf player. I mean, if he has a good caddy, it's a win.
It's a win.
So
it's a guy. It's there to help guys.
But he's always on the side. He's never on the score, never on the... Only one wins the game.
Yeah.
But if you have a good, you know, help, it makes a difference.
I like that Merlot, analogy.
Merlot is a bit like that. It has its own characteristics, but with Sangiovese, the pairing is fantastic, and it is not overwhelmed. I could use 2% of Cabernet Sauvignon in the blend, and you could feel it. Now we use 20%, and you're not sure.
Yeah.
You can't feel it.
Interesting.
Because what we do, what the Merlot does is to give that extra complexity, but it emphasizes Sangiovese positives and kind of smoothen Sangiovese if there are negatives that are a bit this cutting edge that you can find in some wines when they are a bit too extracted. Now, today... Our way of making wine today is not to over-extract and not to pick over-mature, too mature, so after in the cellar not to over-extract, and to be very smooth with the use of, in the aging.
Well, I actually wanted to talk about that because it seemed that there was another philosophical shift that's happened with you guys, you know, a little bit more Merlot with some of the wines, and another one is less time and smaller French barriques and more using the larger barrels. I'm curious what the motivation was for some of the change in your oak treatment when it came to aging your wine.
Le Corti has been always in a certain pattern, so it was kind of out of fashion until 96, 97, then back, and now fully in fashion.
Yeah.
As a starter of the wave, among the start of the wave, and then now what we look, why we use less wood, or why we use older wood, or why we use larger wood to age our wines, or cement. Mm-hmm. For a very basic reason. I like the tannins of the grape. So as soon as I understood that the tannins of the wood were kind of taking the place of the tannins of the grapes, I said, this is not good. This is wrong. It's not my taste. So we are leaving that kind of wood behind and going towards a new way of aging that respects the beauty and the delicacy of the tannins of the grapes.
Yeah. Is that that must be exciting. I mean, or was it nervous for you when you decided, all right, we're going to make these changes, because there is a bit of an unknown into all of that?
Not nervous. You know, as I said, I started managing the property in 1992 when it was all about cement and bulk and all yeah. that. So I went from there into the,
yeah.
into, you know, barriques, new wood, medium toast, heavy toast, highly concentrated grapes. When we picked them, we worked on concentrating extra during mm-hmm. the cellar, in the vinification. So this is a curve of learning,
yeah.
understanding, and going to what you actually are and what you want to be and what you want to show with your wines.
Yeah. It's, by the way, what a crazy adventure and just journey you've gone on. Just a reminder, bulk wine in the early 90s to now, to what you're creating today. Just a couple more questions, then I'll let you go, because, I mean, you got a busy day. You flew in yesterday. You watched the World Cup final on the plane. Now you've got the event, and I imagine you've got an incredibly full schedule. You're a board member of the Chianti Classico Consortium.
Yeah.
And just for people who don't know, it's an organization of local producers in charge of safeguarding the authenticity of true Chianti Classico. And my question is, if it was created to help safeguard, that means that there was dangers or challenges. And I'm wondering, what are the challenges for you in terms of maintaining the authenticity of Chianti Classico? Because you don't start a group like this unless it's a reaction to something.
The history of the Consorzio Chianti Classico goes back to 1716. Mm-hmm. The first regulation of our terroir territory as a wine producer territory was at the Medici time, at the end of the Medici's time.
Yeah.
It was said because the wine was good, it was near to Florence, and they want to put taxes on the wine.
So everything goes back to money.
Tax is also, it's a driver for most things.
Yeah.
In the 30s, when the name Chianti was given to most wines produced in Tuscany, mm-hmm. because it was the most exported Italian wine, there was a need. It was a need to define and to protect and to understand better the original Chianti as the wine made in the geographical Chianti area, that is a small area between Florence and Siena. At that point, they decided to call it Chianti Classico. It was the only way to make a difference. A difference that is still complicated to show, to understand, to teach. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's that. The Consorzio today has the legal duty. It's a legal thing. It's not a volunteer organization. You can be part of it or not, but the organization will overlook, control, and check the whole denomination. Even you that you're not a member of the club, of the consorts. But it's not a club. You cannot keep people away. If you produce wine, you're allowed to be in the club. Even if you're not in the club because you don't want to be, the club will check on your vineyards, will check on the quality of the wine, and will make general decisions for you. So, in a way, it protects and controls the DOCG denomination of Chianti Classico.
And you showed me, before we let you go, I was looking at the Villa Locote. I was wondering, for people Just if you could explain a little bit about the site, about what people would expect if they come and visit you guys in Northern Chianti Classico.
Villa Le Corti was, as I said, it was bought in by my family in 1363.
It's gorgeous. I was just looking at some of the pictures.
It was not exactly like that. At the time, there were three farmhouses and an oil mill.
Yeah.
So in ways, and vines, of course. Uh-huh. In ways, olive, extra virgin olive oil was at the time the bought, convinced to buy the property, the oil mill. So in Le Corti, there is an operative mill since 1363 and never stopped. Mm-hmm. Apart a brief period in for the big frost of 1985 that killed most olives in Chianti and in Tuscany. In 1604, my family decided to build, to destroy what there was there, demolish, and build a huge winery and the villa on top of it. So mm-hmm. it's one huge building, I would say for the time, totally out of scale.
Yeah.
With very, very crazy ideas of way, changing the way of managing the land and managing the tenants and doing wine and doing oil. It was this is what you're going to see. This a Renaissance winery mm-hmm. with a Renaissance villa on top of it, made by an archistar of the time, yeah. Santi di Tito, late Renaissance, and it's probably the largest and unique cellar in Tuscany made at that period. It's just big. It's enormous. If you think that we comfortably operating it in 2017-18 with the same walls, because we can't change that. It's protected by the law. It's a national, even though it's private, it's a national monument since I think 1919.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Corsini, thank you so much for doing this interview. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to trying all the wines tonight, including the very rare Vinsanto. And I imagine you would agree with this. I saw a study last night that came out that said drinking alcohol is more important than exercise for living past 90. I think we can both agree that that study, at least we can agree, that we hope that one is 100% true.
Oh, definitely. It probably is true, but you have to do both.
Yes, absolutely.
Never forget one thing for the other.
Everything in life is about moderation, and yeah, even that sometimes course, in moderation. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Ciao.